From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, with 17 state propositions on our ballots this year, California voters have plenty to research. So it's no surprise they're often unfamiliar with candidates for a Superior Court judge or unaware of whether they want to keep an incumbent judge. In this hour of Forum, we look at how California elects its judges and what voters can do to become better informed about judicial candidates. We'll also examine the question of whether we should do away with judicial elections entirely. We get started after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim, sitting in today for Michael Krasny. A perennial question from our listeners, particularly during election years, is why do we elect judges? And it's often asked with a concern of being unqualified to make an informed choice. With judges on the ballot in several Bay Area counties, and growing interest in who our local judges are after the launch of a high-profile recall campaign of a Santa Clara judge, we take this hour to evaluate California's judicial election system, the pros and cons of electing our judges, and what we can do to make a more informed choice about them when often so little information is readily available. Joining me for the hour are Jessica Levinson, professor of election law at Loyola Law School. Good morning, Jessica Levinson.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. We're also joined by Chris Bono. He's associate professor of political science at the University of Pittsburgh. Good morning, Chris Bono. Though I guess it's not morning anymore in Pittsburgh.
No, you guys are lucky.
And we're also joined by Arthur Scotland. He's a retired presiding judge at the California Court of Appeal, 3rd Appellate District, and he currently practices law with the Nielsen Merkzimmer Law Firm in Sacramento. Good morning, Arthur Scotland.
Good morning. Pleased to be here. Thank you.
Pleased to have you. And I'd also like to start with you, if I could. California has a hybrid system right now in terms of how judges are elected and appointed. Could you explain which ones are elected and which ones are appointed?
Yes, actually, the election process is different with respect to trial judges compared to appellate justices. There are three levels of judicial officers in California: trial judges, called Superior Court judges, intermediate appellate justices, Court of Appeal justices, and then justices of the highest state court, the California Supreme Court, and all are nonpartisan officers. The vast majority of trial judges are appointed by the governor to six-year terms. Then they must stand for election when their terms expire. So occasionally, a trial judge might be challenged by an attorney who wants to become a judge but hasn't been appointed by the governor. Thus, the judge's name and the name or names of challengers are on the primary election ballot, with a runoff in the general election if no one gets 50% plus one of the vote. Occasionally, a few judges complete their term and do not seek election to a new term, and this opens up the office to a contested election of attorneys seeking to fill that open position. So in California, relatively few judges initially take office by election. Almost all are appointed by the governor. But occasionally there are elections, and the process is completely different for appellate justices. There are no contested races for Supreme Court and Court of Appeal justices. They take office only by appointment by the governor, subject to confirmation by a commission. Then they must stand for voter confirmation at the next gubernatorial election cycle. It's a yes-no vote. No one can run against them. And then at the expiration of the justice's term, he or she must again be on the ballot for a retention election, again a yes-no vote, whether the justice should be elected to a new term. So that's how it operates in California.
So, Arthur Scotland, if I understand you correctly, appellate and Supreme Court justices are appointed by the governor, and they serve 12-year terms?
Correct.
And if you're saying that they are up for a retention vote during gubernatorial years, do you mean every 12 years when it falls, and it falls on a gubernatorial year, or do you mean every time there's a gubernatorial election?
No, only every time there's a gubernatorial election, there will be some justices of the California Court of Appeal or Supreme Court whose terms are expiring.
So the 12-year term.
Then be on the 12-year term, correct.
I see. And you know, I think we all think we know what a judge does, of course, but I just want to hear from you, what is the duty of a judge? Why does it matter so much who serves as judges?
Well, the duties of judges are broad. Fortunately, in our system, we have a court system in which people can air their disputes. If people are charged with crimes, there's a vehicle for the citizens to prosecute those individuals, and judges have responsibility for making sure that juries apply rules of law, making sure that the evidence that's admitted is admissible, making sure that the system follows the rules and people get fair and impartial trials. And then there are many other types of disputes, contract disputes, employment law disputes, any number, election law disputes, any number of disputes. And we have a system where there is a resolution of those issues with a judge or judges essentially supervising and ensuring that the rules are applied, the laws are applied, there's fairness in the proceedings, and hopefully a just result occurs in every case.
Yes. And Jessica Levinson, so judges make, as Arthur Scotland is making clear to us, hundreds of very important decisions about our lives every day, from murder to employment to divorces. And you feel like it's important that they not be elected. Could you talk a little bit about why?
Sure. I think for a couple of reasons. And one of the main reasons is, you know, we just talked about all the important things that they do. One of the things that I don't want them to do is worry about winning a popularity contest every, you know, X number of years in order to make sure that they can keep their jobs. So judges apply, you know, very broadly the facts to the law and make a determination about what the law dictates. Now, sometimes there's a matter where it's unclear, and that's why often we have appellate decisions where there really isn't something, you know, quote unquote, on all fours. But when judges are making these decisions, sometimes they're unpopular. Sometimes the judiciary's role is to focus on individual or minority rights and think about how those rights are affected under the law. Now, what I don't, again, want judges to do is to think, well, you know, how is this going to play with the people who live in, for instance, I'm in LA County. Will this turn people off in the next election? Will someone want to run against me because it's an unpopular perspective? Now, to take a, you know, extreme example, let's think about interracial marriage, where, you know, you don't want a judge decades ago to think about, well, I think this is the right decision if I apply the Constitution, if I look at the law, but it's probably not a popular decision and I really like my job. So that's one of the issues, is I don't want judges who, in a lot of ways, are, I think, the last, you know, stop on the train to tyranny of the majority, to be worried about what the majority thinks. Another reason is, you know, who do we think judges are getting money from when they run for election? It's people that they know. And so they are, and this isn't saying that they're evil or that contributors are evil, but judges are asking lawyers and people who may at some point come before them or have some interest in ensuring that they're on the bench for a campaign contribution. Now, I think the idea of judges having to ask people for money in order to obtain their jobs is really kind of problematic and distasteful. Just like you don't want judges worrying about what do the voters think, you don't want judges worrying about what are my contributors going to think. So, and, you know,
Sorry, go ahead. Would you then support an appointed system only?
I would support the system that we have on the appellate and Supreme Court level, where we have this kind of hybrid that the judge talked about, where we have a commission which vets a number of candidates and then makes a recommendation to the governor, and then the governor would then appoint, and then they stand for retention election.
And can you explain what a retention election is and how it's different from a trial judge
election? Sure. So a retention election means I'm the only name on the ballot, and the idea is, do you retain me? Do I keep my job, or do I lose my job? I'm not up against somebody else. So it's not a contested election would be the contrast to that. Now, I'm not actually an enormous fan of retention election at all. I think once you have appointed someone, we can look to the federal level, which I think works very well, where judges have lifetime appointments for exactly the reason that we've discussed, which is they need some independence from popular will. And the last thing I was going to mention is these are very, very low information elections. So unfortunately, I feel that every time we vote for judges, I probably end up, you know, by proxy voting for about 200 different people because so many people say, who should I vote for? I don't know anything about this. The only information we have is, you know, the three-word description on the ballot and their name, which really only tells us maybe their heritage and their gender. Those are bad ways to choose who's going to be a judge. And we know from some studies that people tend to use these cues like, well, I like to vote for men, or I like to vote for women, or I like to vote for people with Anglo-Saxon names. That's not a good way to choose, again, who's going to make these really important decisions about our lives.
Chris Bono, so Jessica Levinson is laying out some concerns about our current election, judicial election system, namely that voters tend not to know enough about the judges that they're voting for, and also that judges have to consider then how their decisions will play in the next election. But you support judicial elections. Why?
Yeah, so there's actually a lot in there. So let me try and unpack a lot of the different claims that were made. In terms of judges, you know, needing to take into account what the public thinks about their decisions, there's actually a very good advantage to that, which is sometimes bad judges get on the bench, and sometimes judges on the bench make bad decisions. With regular elections, you can correct that. When you have appointments and you have a system which is very difficult to remove judges, it makes it impossible to punish rogue judges, short of impeachment, which is very, very rare. And the notion of preventing a tyranny majority, I think, is an important concern, but I do think we overestimate and we overstate, and the political science literature has spoken to this, just how good the courts have been on that. You know, everyone wants to talk about Brown v. Board of Education at the U.S. Supreme Court, but let's not forget before Brown, we had Plessy, which was a U.S. Supreme Court decision. And before that, we had Dred Scott. Everyone likes the gay marriage cases that came out of the Supreme Court, but before that, we had Bowers v. Hardwick, which was done by the same Supreme Court. So this notion that appointed judges who are unaccountable to the people are somehow the last bastion of the protection of minority rights is just not borne out.
What do you think then of
by the evidence?
What do you think then of retention elections? So rather than saying you vote against other candidates, that these trial court justices would be appointed and then you could vote yes or no when they're at the end of their term and up for re-election on the ballot, as opposed to having them be up against other folks on the ballot. Do you think that that's a valid way to exercise your ability?
Well, I think retention elections are problematic for two different reasons.
Okay.
One, it's unfair to the voters in the sense that it doesn't give the voters meaningful choice. It gives the voters a choice of should, you know, Judge Brown keep her job, yes or no. It doesn't allow the voters to make a choice as to who should replace Judge Brown. I mean, if we think about doing Senate elections like that or presidential elections like that, it's really a perverse thing that you may not like how this judge is doing his job, but you don't know what the current governor is going to pick in his or her place. And so that's problematic. And it's also unfair, actually, to candidates as well, because with contested elections, you have filing deadlines. And so you know if you're in a contested election whether or not you're going to have an opponent. And so if you don't have an opponent, you don't need to worry about raising money. You don't need to worry about doing any campaigning or anything else because you're guaranteed to win. With retention election, there are no opponents. So what can happen is you could think everything's fine. You can think you're not going to have any kind of competition. You're not going to have any kind of group threatening your seat. And then 2 weeks before the election, a group comes in and puts a $3 million ad buy against you. And you're completely unprepared to respond to those criticisms about some of your past decisions because you haven't been raising money, you haven't laid the infrastructure for your retention bid because you didn't think it was going to be any issue. And so for judges standing for retention, they're really, you know, vulnerable to these kind of guerrilla tactics. And so for those two reasons, I think retention elections in many ways are highly disadvantageous to both voters and to the candidates.
Well, Arthur Scotland is somebody who had to undergo these processes, right? You had to be elected, or I assume so, actually, I don't know. But as an appellate judge, you definitely had to stand for a retention election as well. What are the effects of those? Did you ever worry about whether your decisions would, you know, disenfranchise voters?
I think it was a practical matter.
Turn off voters, I should say. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Most judges don't think about that. You have a responsibility. You have an oath of office to apply the law in a fair and unbiased manner and let the chips fall where they may. So I think most, certainly appellate court justices, don't think about that when they're making rulings. You know, when you're thinking of elections versus appointment only, reasonable arguments can be made for or against either system. Assuming office through election does allow public input and some degree of accountability, but also it allows special interest groups to contribute millions of dollars in an effort to elect judges who they think are more likely to rule in favor of those interests. And many states have partisan judicial elections, which candidates run as Republican or Democrat or something else. And that politicizes the judiciary, which I think is a very bad thing. And elections are not necessarily merit-based. In California, you have a judicial appointment system that is merit-based. Candidates have to go through an extensive screening. They have to go through an investigation and evaluation based on a variety of factors, including professional ability, legal experience, temperament, work ethic, lack of bias. There are several bodies that do that, two different commissions. This is all good. On the other hand, without periodic retention elections as in California, judges would have life tenure, like in federal courts. And reasonable arguments can be made for and against life tenure. On one hand, life tenure ensures judicial independence because judges can make proper but unpopular decisions without fear of retribution. But on the other hand, removal only for high crimes and misdemeanors does not allow removal of judges who have shown that they lack the temperament to be a good judge, they treat people badly, they're rude, who may lack objectivity, or who have shown that they might have some sort of a personal or political agenda. So in essence, California has a hybrid system. It's not perfect. You know, nothing's perfect. But I think it's the best of both worlds. It's a merit-based appointment system for the vast majority of trial judges and for all appellate justices who assume office only through gubernatorial appointment. And subsequent retention elections provide a form of accountability. If a judge has shown that he or she lacks the temperament to be an effective and proper judge or who abuses his or her powers, then there is a vehicle by which to not allow that person to go on to another term. And you know, if the system were changed to appointment only followed by retention election, as Professor Levinson suggests, the problem with that is it would be unworkable as to trial judges, because every election cycle, numerous names would be on the ballot for retention election, numerous trial court judges. For example, in Los Angeles, there would be 20, 30, many, and that would clog the ballot. It would be very burdensome for voters, and it would be difficult for most voters to learn about those candidates, although I'd be happy to share with you a lot of resources that voters can turn to.
Sure, and I'd like to get to that, and I'd also like to give Jessica Levinson a chance to respond. But just before, I want to ask you, is there a gap then that you're saying between all this evaluating that happens to appoint judges and the information that voters are given when they vote on keeping them on the bench?
Well, there's a gap to the extent that all of this information is not readily available to voters, but they can turn to a number of things. For example, in retention elections, the League of Women Voters publishes a voter guide that contains biographies and other information about all the justices that are up for retention. The California Channel interviews justices up for retention, and they stream videos prior to the election so people can go onto that channel. The Judicial Council website, you know, www.courts.ca.gov, that contains biographies of the justices and other information. Some local county bar associations publish evaluations of candidates. And then, of course, you have candidates' ballot statements and that sort of thing.
Jessica
but
Levinson.
That means work. That's work for the voter.
Yes, it is work for the voter. And that's part of my question to Jessica Levinson. One is it as accessible as Arthur Scotland may be suggesting here? The other is, if there was adequate information and it was easy to access, would you then be more in favor of elected judges?
So yes and no. So the information is out there. It's accessible. And I think we know from voters and from political science and social science and legal studies that voters just don't engage on the particularly down ballot questions in the fashion that they would need to in order to make an informed decision on judges. And so what we're oftentimes, for the people who kind of bother to look into this, what they're doing is they're just saying, well, what does the LA Times say? Or what does the San Francisco Chronicle say? For those voters who are going one step further, they're looking at a bar association, for instance, the LA County Bar Association, which ranks candidates, but sometimes two candidates have the same ranking. They're both well qualified or not qualified. So that's only helpful to a limited extent. So there are absolutely resources out there, but the number of people who I know who are politically engaged and still don't go in and do the research on judges, I think is very high. And, you know, another thing I would say in response to some previous comments that were made is there's also a lot of social science that shows that judges who are elected, and there's some recent studies by the Brennan Center and the and a group called Justice at Stake, that they tend to do things like be harder on criminal defendants closer in time to an election because they don't want to be pegged on being soft on crime. It was also mentioned that maybe you need time to ramp up because there might be an ad buy coming. Well, I think the idea that a judge would be worried about an ad buy is exactly why they should not stand for election. And what we've seen in states throughout the nation is that we see there's an exponential growth in these outside spending groups, particularly for state Supreme Courts, where they think, I might have an issue coming before the court, and I want to ensure that the court has a particular composition. And, you know, I would also say that, you know, I hear a lot of times, well, we don't just appoint our senators, or we don't just appoint our president or our city council person. Those people are supposed to do something very different. They are supposed to represent the majority of their constituents. Judges are not charged with doing that. So that's just a few responses.
And judges also make decisions basically individually.
Yeah, exactly.
When they do
so
their
it's
rulings.
Not. Well, and I mean, there are some judges who obviously sit in panels, but most of what judges do, and Judge Scotland, of course, knows this better than I do, you know, is an independent pursuit. And it's they shouldn't have in mind what will the people who might vote for me think. And I agree with the judge that I think that most judges are quite honorable and they don't have that in mind. But there's really no reason to put that potential fear onto them.
Well, we're coming up on a break, and I want to give Chris Bono a chance after the break to comment on all the different things that you brought up related to elected judges. But I just want to quickly ask you for your response then to Judge Scotland's point that it would clog the ballot if you had these retention elections. And you were already expressing concern, Jessica Levinson, about the fact that there's this ballot roll-off when there's so many things on the ballot.
Yeah, exactly. I think drop-off is a real concern, and this is actually why I think that retention elections are not a perfect solution. And Judge Scotland said something which is so true. There are arguments on both sides. It's not like if we just have an appointment process, well, we're good to go because everything's going to be perfect. There is an issue that we will sometimes be stuck with judges who we don't like. And so we're just kind of weighing the benefits and the detriments. One of the detriments, obviously, is that we would have this incredibly long ballot, particularly in places like LA, where we've consolidated state and local elections. I hear the music, but I think there are some solutions to that.
And we can get to those after the break. We're looking at how California elects its judges and what voters can do to become better informed about judicial candidates. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 866-733-6786. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. With judges on the ballot in several Bay Area counties and growing interest in who our local judges are after the launch of a high-profile recall campaign of a Santa Clara judge, we're evaluating California's judicial election system and figuring out what we can do to make a more informed decision about our judges. We're talking with Jessica Levinson, professor of election law at Loyola Law School, Chris Bono, associate professor of political science at the University of Pittsburgh, and also Arthur Scotland, a retired presiding judge with the California Court of Appeal. Chris Bono, quickly before I go to calls, I do want to give you a chance to respond to the points that Jessica Levinson was making, that there's been evidence that judges tend to be tougher when they're approaching their election, that they tend to hand down stiffer sentences. I think I read in the Brennan Center's report on this that they can impose longer sentences, even override sometimes life sentences to impose the death penalty. Could you respond to that?
That's actually unconstitutional, but the death penalty part. So let me just say a few things in response to what's been said. I'd be very wary of the you know, positions of groups like the Brennan Center and Justice at Stake, which exists solely to eradicate elections. But regarding that, the judges becoming more punitive, I mean, judges have discretion. This is one of the reasons why they ought to be elected in the Commons of the People. If a judge has the discretion within his or her power to sentence someone to between 10 and 20 years under the sentencing guidelines and under the statutes, who are we to say that a more punitive sentence is not more just than a less punitive sentence? We seem to assume that just because they're becoming more punitive means that somehow they're not following the law. They are following the law. They're just using their discretion.
Well, what about a group like... Sorry, go ahead.
No, and so if society judges, right, or judges think that society wants people to be more punitive, I might disagree with that normatively, but that's not, you know, that's what judges say. And part of the issue here, I think, is, you know, I agree with the judge that there's no perfect system, and I agree with that completely. But what ends up happening, I think, is we compare electing judges to this, you know, standard of appointment where somehow is pure. But basically what it comes down to is whether or not you want your politics in judicial selection, because it exists everywhere. We can see that with Merrick Garland now being stalled at the U.S. Supreme Court level for no reason other than politics. Do you want to be transparent, that is, out in the public, in front of the people to see, open up the black box and see what happens with elections? Or do you want to be non-transparent, right, where judicial selection occurs among the elites, behind closed doors, without any public input, without any kind of transparency? And I think when we think about how we all select judges, as opposed to independence versus accountability, which all systems provide elements of both, I think transparency versus non-transparency is more useful, which is why voters like electing judges. Every time you do a survey of voters, about anywhere from two-thirds to three-quarters of voters will say, yes, we want to keep electing our judges.
Well, what about groups like Lambda Legal? If you take issue with Brennan, they released a report that found that elected judges are less likely to support gay rights.
Mm-hmm. Sure, but where do elected judges? Where are judges elected? Right in the U.S., mostly in the South. My suspicion is that it has more to do with where states happen to elect judges than it does with the election of judges per se. And the other thing that's interesting about judges not having representative role like legislators, if you ask people what are the expectations of a good judge, Jim Gibson has done some excellent work on this, both in Kentucky and nationwide. And so his survey of Kentuckians, right, so what are the expectations of a good judge? 72.9% say it's very important for judges to protect people without power. 71.9% said strictly follow the law. But then you also have 46.5% say represent the majority. And 43.7% say, give my ideology a voice. People know what judges do, and people know that judges don't just simply sit back in isolation and simply look at the facts and the law, that there's a lot of discretion in judging, that judges' role is to protect people, to not necessarily just strictly follow the law, and they're not disturbed when judges do this.
Well, let's hear what our listeners have to say. Colin in San Francisco, good morning.
Good morning. Judge Aaron Persky of Santa Clara County Superior Court had sentenced Brock Turner, the Stanford rapist, to a sentence of less than a year for what was a sexual assault.
And what is that? Yeah. Mm-hmm. What does that say to you?
I recall there being a huge outcry about that, particularly Judge Persky's comments that a greater sentence would have a severe impact on this privileged young man, and considerations such as his being a Stanford athlete coming into the picture.
So does that say to you, Colin?
Does the selection of Judge Persky on the by the Commission for Selecting Judges show that the system of selecting judges in California is not doing a good job in selecting for bias, particularly bias on the behalf of privileged defendants in sexual assault cases?
Mm-hmm. Good question, Colin. And yeah, so just to give listeners a little more background, Aaron Persky was initially appointed by Governor Gray Davis, and then he was up for election. His term was ending, but he was running unopposed, so he does not appear on the ballot this year, is my understanding. And so your question, Colin, is what does it really indicate about our judicial election system, about whether or not it's doing a good job? And I think Catherine in Sunnyvale has a question related to the recall for Persky. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning. My question is related to your previous caller. I'm wondering, I've heard some comments that the recall election sets a bad precedent over the for, you know, if a judge can be recalled, what does that do for a judge's discretion? I was wondering if you might have comments on why this would or would not be a bad precedent for us to recall Judge Persky for making bad decisions.
Catherine, thanks.
I would be happy to.
Arthur Scotland, I there's not that much research, at least that I was able to find, on the effect of judicial recalls. Can you talk a little bit about that and the concerns about them, and but also whether or not they indicate that we do need to make some changes in our judicial election system?
Certainly, and I think it's important to start by explaining sentencing rules. Judges have limited discretion because it's the legislature that defines crimes and sets the range of punishment. For some serious crimes, the legislature has prohibited granting probation and compelled commitments to state prison. No such limitations existed in the Brock-Turner case. Thus, the judge had limited discretion to grant probation with or without jail time, to sentence to prison for a lower, middle, or upper term. Now, judges can't sentence based on whim. They have to follow established rules that are set forth in the penal code and established rules of court. Thus, in determining what sentence to impose, the judge has to consider what's called circumstances in mitigation and circumstances in aggravation relating to the crime and the offender. So the judge also has to consider a report prepared by the county probation department, which has a responsibility to do a major background investigation, prepare a social history report, and recommend a sentence. So the judge in the Brock-Turner case imposed the sentence recommended by the probation department in light of the circumstances and aggravation and mitigation identified by the probation department. It was a lawful sentence within the discretion given to the judge by the legislature based on the crime as defined at that time. So regardless of how one feels about the sentence, it is unreasonable and unfair to call for a judge's removal from office for one decision that was lawful and even recommended by the probation department, but with which many disagree. And the dangerous precedent, and I really liked the question by the second caller, and that is, it would set a dangerous precedent. Do we really want to have judges looking over their shoulders and worrying about public outcry and calls for removal from office every time they issue a decision? Do we really want to dissuade judges from making decisions like Brown v. Board of Education, which rejected so-called separate but equal schools based on race as a violation of equal protection of minorities? That decision was not popular. Indeed, it was condemned in the South when it was issued. It would frankly be a sorry state of affairs if public pressure causes trial judges to hold their fingers to the wind and rule based on public sentiment rather than impartial rules of the law.
Jessica,
so,
yes.
If you want to change the laws, if you don't like the result of that case and you want to change the laws as it did, you do it through legislative action if appropriate. You don't undermine the judiciary simply because a judge issued one lawful but unpopular decision. I think that is a dangerous precedent.
Jessica Levinson, do you think California's system for recalling judges is an argument for or against electing them?
Well, first, I just want to say, I think Judge Scotland laid this out so well. This has been a discussion that, you know, very reasonably we've had where a lot of people disagree with the sentence, but it was a legal sentence and it was within discretion. And I think there's been a lot of talk about systemic solutions, frankly, in search of a problem. And so I think that that was an incredibly articulate response to why the recall is troublesome in this case. And so do I think the recall is a good solution? I frankly worry about the recall for exactly the reasons that Judge Scotland just talked about, which is that that judges would be worried, and I think he said put their fingers to the wind and think about, well, is there a group that would try to recall me? And so I think that the better option would be to have a commission like the Jenny Commission to look at whether or not judges need to be punished or whether or not there needs to be something to happen to judges. But a recall, again, infuses the process with a majoritarian will, which makes me very uncomfortable. And exactly as the judge said, you know, we decide to put people on the court and
understand that they're going to exercise their discretion. And that may or may not be popular, but I don't want that to come into play when they're making their decisions.
Jessica Levinson, can appointed and elected judges be recalled? Both can.
Yes.
And
on the state level.
And California's system for recall, is it just if the folks who want to recall this particular judge are able to collect the necessary signatures and do all the necessary work to get the judge's name on the ballot for recall? Or does the judge have to commit something egregious?
No. Well, and I think we're seeing this exactly in the judge Persky case, which is the judge can do something legal and still be subject to the recall. So a recall for your listeners, I think maybe you think about it like the ballot initiative process, where you don't necessarily need a good idea or maybe even a lawful idea, but what you need is the ability to gather signatures, you know, within the time frame and adhere to all of the procedures, as you said.
And Chris Bono, do you have a response to this in terms of the ability to recall judges? Do you feel like it's an important right that citizens should have? Because only eight states,
like,
I believe, do it.
Quite a few. I don't know the exact number, so I don't want to.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think it's 39 states that allow it, eight states that require malfeasance, essentially, to be criteria.
Yeah, actually, I don't like recall elections in general for any office. I think that, you know, if people didn't like how Judge Persky did his job, someone should challenge him in the election. And if they don't like how he's doing his job 6 years from now, somebody should challenge him in the election. I mean, that's the choice that people have. I think recall elections in general for any office just get into this whole notion of, you know, I don't like what happened, so I'm going to try a do-over. And it's messy, it's expensive, and I'm not sure what the end goal is. No one decided to challenge Judge Persky. People don't like this one decision. And, you know, if it was a pattern of decisions, I would think he would have been challenged by somebody else. And so that gets to the point that you know, both other people made, right, about how should one bad decision cost somebody their job? You know, I would say probably not. But I'm not opposed to it because that's what elections are for. And if the voters decide that this one bad decision is so egregious that this person is unfit to serve on the bench, they should choose to remove him. But the fact that no one challenged him and so he's running uncontested this year suggests that, in general, people didn't have a problem with him.
Well, let's hear what Sarah has to say. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning. I'm so glad that you're having a program on this topic, because I have looked on a number of occasions for information about the judges on the ballot, and I've never been able to find anything very helpful. I'm not really interested in their credentials. I presume they wouldn't be on the bench if they hadn't been vetted and their credentials weren't good. And by the time they get to the point of making decisions, you know, where they went to college doesn't really matter that much to me. But I am interested in the cases over which they presided and what their judgments have been, and I have looked high and low and been unable to find that information. So if your panelists could give me some guidance on how to find the cases on which any of the judges on the ballot have sat or presided and what their decisions have been, that would be most helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Jessica Levinson, is there some system where we can look up what cases judges have presided over?
I'm going to give you an unsatisfactory answer, which is I'm both going to say I don't think so and punt to Judge Scotland, because I've actually looked for the same information. And you can look up judges there's a database called Westlaw or Lexis, which frankly you need a password to use. And you can look to newspapers that might talk about that information, but I want to emphasize might talk about that information. So I hear your caller's frustration. I think I don't have a good answer to that. I don't believe that information is readily accessible.
Arthur Scotland, is there some kind of a resource right now that is fairly uniform where we could type in a judge's name and figure out what cases they presided over?
There is, to a certain extent. Every decision of the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court has to be a written opinion with reasons stated. And then some are deemed to be published cases where they go into the legal precedent, the books, and others are what are called unpublished opinions because they don't raise significant issues of law and that sort of thing. And those are available to the public for 90 days on the Judicial Council website. What a voter could do, it's a lot of work. Unfortunately, it is a lot of work. You have to be active, and you could look through both the unpublished opinions of the Court of Appeal and Supreme Court and the published opinions, and you can read what the issues were, how the trial judge ruled, the rationale of the trial judge, and then how the Court of Appeal of the Supreme Court ultimately decided that case. So, yes, there is a basis, but that's only on the cases that have gone up on appeal. If you're asking for every single decision that a trial judge makes, almost 1,700 trial judges throughout the state of California, I don't think that there's a database that is easily accessible.
Well, Michael writes, I don't care how many websites I visit. I'm no more qualified to select judges than I am to set FDA regulations regarding certain organic compounds. Terry writes, these people are so important in establishing justice for those on trial. I really want to vote for a good candidate, but have been completely flummoxed by being unable to learn anything about the individuals running. Jessica Levinson, because this is upon us, could you just outline what your process is within the constraints of information that we have available to us? What is your process for finding out about your judge?
And so I just want to say, you know, to your listeners, I hear your frustration. I apologize. With respect to the last question, I thought we were talking about Superior Court judges, because those are mostly the ones we see, at least in Los Angeles, on our ballots.
Yeah.
So what I do is I have an Excel spreadsheet. And so I list all the candidates who are up, and I then put into a different box every source of information I can find on the candidates. So maybe it's the League of Women Voters, it's the Los Angeles County Bar Association, it's the Los Angeles Times, it's another media outlet called the Met News. And I go across and I read everything that I can about these judges. And then I'm in the position of I'm in the very lucky position of being able to talk to some people who work in the court system. And then I kind of aggregate all of that information in case people ask me. That takes hours. And, you know, I am an election law professor, and so I feel like it's part of my job, but it's not easy. And I have to say that I often don't feel that I have clarity. And I often feel, particularly when I'm looking at newspaper endorsements, that I think the newspapers do the best job that they can, but it often leaves me feeling, let's say, unsatiated.
Well, Jessica Levinson is professor of election law at Loyola Law School. Chris Bono, associate professor of political science at University of Pittsburgh. And we're talking with Arthur Scotland, a retired presiding judge for the California Court of Appeal. And we're talking with you, our listeners, about electing judges in California, how California elects its judges, and what voters can do to become better informed. We do have a link on our website to voters' edge guides to the Superior Court races that are occurring locally. And so I encourage voters to do that. But again, it will be fairly limited information. Let's go next to Richard in San Francisco. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I happen to be an attorney, and I've been before lots of judges and in the Court of Appeal. And I would have to say that I never encountered a judge that I thought was really incompetent. We do have a system in California where Court of Appeals and Supreme Court judges come up for, I guess you would call it re-election, every 10 years. But the system is such that you get to vote yes or no. So if there's a terrible animosity towards a particular judge, that judge could be voted out of office. And I think that's the same system we ought to have for Superior Court judges. There is no reason for us ever to elect a Superior Court judge. I mean, no one but the attorneys who appear before them are going to know very much about their judicial qualities. So I think they ought to just have a yes or no election at the end of their term.
Well, Richard,
can I add one thing? One of the problems with our judicial system is that we have what's called a Commission on Judicial Performance, which anyone can complain to about a judge, but it operates in total secrecy.
Hmm.
And so we never know whether or not, unless someone is disbarred.
Well, Richard, thanks for adding that point, because I think it's a good one. In terms of the ability to remove justices who may have done things that warrant at least a review, Richard raises the point about the commission that was actually written about by San Francisco Chronicle's Bob Agielko, who we talked to before this, who also said that he has someone who's covered judicial elections and the judiciary for a long time, himself has difficulty learning about these judges. But the Commission on Judicial Performance, Arthur Scotland, there have been some complaints about the fact that it operates in near secrecy and that it dismisses, as Agelko has reported, nearly 90% of the public complaints it receives and imposes discipline much less often than states like Arizona, Texas, and New York. Is our system of removing problematic judges, problematic in itself?
I don't believe so. First of all, the commission is made up of 11 individuals, three of whom are appointed by the Chief Justice of California, four who are appointed by the governor, two have to be public members, two have to be attorney members, and then two appointed by the Speaker of the Assembly, both public members, and two by the President Pro Tem of the Senate. It has the responsibility. Anyone can complain about a judicial decision. And then once a complaint is filed, there's an investigation that's done. And let's be candid about this. Many people complain about decisions simply because they lost. It doesn't mean that the judge committed some misconduct. But sometimes there are judges that do inappropriate things. And so the commission will look into it. It will actually do an investigation. It will actually start. It will do charges against the judge, and then there's a hearing. And people can testify for and against about the alleged misconduct, or frankly, if a judge has become incapacitated to be able to perform the duties, and then the judge could be removed by the Commission on Judicial Performance. And I think that's one thing that voters should keep in mind. We're asking a lot for voters to look to all of these sources to try to find more information about the judges. But unless there's an extraordinary reason not to, voters should vote for the incumbent judge. And I'm not just being a shill. First of all, only the incumbent judge has gone through the vigorous evaluation process and found to be qualified to serve as a judge. There's the governor's initial assessment. There's a Commission on Judicial Nominees Evaluation, of which I was a member, that does a very thorough. They send out thousands of confidential questionnaires to get feedback from judges and attorneys. There's a local bar evaluations. If it's a court of appeal or Supreme Court, there's a Commission on Judicial Appointments that has to confirm the appointments. Second, only the judge has obtained continuing legal education on judicial performance, process, the law, including ethics, impartiality, cultural competence. These education programs are continuous, and judges attend those. And third, there is this disciplinary process to sanction a judge who's engaged in misconduct. So when an incumbent judge is up for election, voters can consider the fact that the judge was found qualified for office and hasn't been found to have committed any misconduct justifying removal.
All right.
And then, so there you go.
Well, let's go to Kit next in Mill Valley. Hi, Kit.
Hi. I had a comment about an earlier comment by, I believe, Judge Scotland that said there were published and unpublished opinions. I think there should be an index of unpublished opinions that is available to the public, because unpublished opinions can be used as a means to duck tough issues. And in one case I'm familiar with, you know, it means your odds of getting it to the Supreme Court are reduced because it isn't precedent, and nobody ever sees the judge's decision. So I think there should be access to unpublished opinions, even not as precedent, but when somebody's running for re-election.
Well, Kit, thanks for that, and I'm going to let it stand because we're close to the end of the hour, and I want to get Andre in San Francisco in here. Andre?
Hello, thanks. I wanted to highlight one local race. It's Superior Court Judge in Alameda County. There is an instance where you have two candidates. One is vastly more qualified, Scott Jackson, who is running. He's been endorsed by over 80% of the Alameda County Bar Association and the plebiscite, over three dozen judges, the Alameda County DA, public defender, and sheriff. Whereas his opponent seems to only have met the minimum requirement to run, which is being able to pay the filing fee and is a current member of the Bar Association. So in cases like this, where you have one clearly more qualified candidate than the other, does it make the panelists rethink or reconsider their respective stances on the merits of electing judges? And this is particularly for county Superior Court judges.
Well, Andre, thanks for that. Is there anybody who wants to respond to Andre?
Sure, I'll take that.
Chris Bono.
Sure, I would say that, yeah, first of all, in California, you also have to be a practicing lawyer or a member of the bar for 10 years, I believe. So it's not that this person is just paid a filing fee or whatever else. And, you know, in elections, sometimes the best candidate loses. Right, and it happens for all kinds of things. Just like an appointment, sometimes the best candidate doesn't get appointed. But because, I mean, individual anecdotes or individual decisions tend to stick out in our minds, right, because of recency effects and salience and everything else. But, you know, in general, voters, you know, we have empirical evidence that voters know what they're doing in the sense that they are able to identify which candidate is more qualified, and the candidate that's more qualified when they challenge an incumbent, you know, does about 5 points better than somebody who's not qualified. And that's at the state Supreme Court level. We don't know a lot about the trial court level. In the trial court level, there's a lot of elections and things can get a little messier. But I'm much more optimistic based on the evidence that we have that voters know enough. Now, do they have all the perfect information? Of course not. And they don't for any office. But they certainly know at least as much, you know, with judges that they do for other offices they're voting for.
Well, the election and appointment hybrid system is the system that we do have. And I hope during this hour we were able to give our listeners a sense of some of the strategies folks who really care about who our judges are using to try to get the information that they need to select the best judge for the job. Thank you so much, Jessica Levinson, professor of election law at Loyola Law School, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks also to you, Arthur Scotland, retired presiding judge at California Court of Appeal.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And Chris Bono, associate professor of political science at University of Pittsburgh. We thank you for being with us this morning as well.
Thanks for having us.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauberg, and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Schofer-Wolf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and Joanne Wallace is our executive producer. I'm Mina Kim in for Michael Krasny. Thank you for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.